Hello, everybody, and welcome to Fire Engineering Talk Radio and another installment of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, the podcast that is dedicated to our great volunteer fire service and getting firefighters to embrace the message that developing and displaying and maintaining a professional image is the duty and responsibility of all firefighters, whether paid or volunteer. Tom Merrill here. So glad to have you joining me for another great show. And you know what? I am still so freaking pumped up and energized from another great FDIC experience. Now, FDIC was just a couple weeks ago in Indianapolis, and I got to tell you, it was freaking awesome. The attendance was fantastic. I think everyone was a little concerned because, you know, understandably, it got changed a couple times. So people were worried the attendance might drop off. But I'm hearing it was over 24,000, something around 24,500 people attended. And I mean, that's really good. Took so many great classes too. In my live podcast from FDIC, I had a guest, fellow Commissioner Paul Griebner, was on with me, and we reviewed some of the classes we attended up until that point. And, you know, there's always so many great classes, it's hard to choose which ones you really want to go to. And Paul and I both agreed that every class we took was fantastic. Everything was great. And we didn't have a bad one in the bunch that we took up until that point. And I took a bunch after that, as did Commissioner Griebner. As a matter of fact, I think I took 11 classes all told. And I told myself, Tom, you got to stop looking in the class catalog, because once Friday came, I needed to get out on the floor, on the trade show floor, because that is so huge that it takes a long time to go and see everything. So I said, no more looking in the class catalog, Tom. You're going to go to the show all day Friday. So what did I do? I looked in the class catalog and I saw a class for Friday morning that I said, you know, this would really help me with my paid job, because it was a class on everything you need to know about fire alarm systems, you know, like those automatic alarms. And certainly those are a huge part of our fire department response, right? And they're a big part of my job at the alarm office. And so I went to the class and it talked all about understanding these alarm systems and understanding what a supervisory signal is, as opposed to maybe a trouble signal. And so that class by Deputy Chief, his name was Steve Heckman, and he was from Maine, Trenton, Maine Volunteer Fire Department, I believe. And it was all about these alarm systems. And then I said, okay, no more, Tom, you can't go to any more classes. But as I'm in the class, I'm going through the catalog and I see another class at 10:30 that looked really good. And that was a leadership class by Indianapolis Fire Department Battalion Chief Candace Ashby. And let me tell you, I wasn't going to go, but there was something about this class that made me say, go check it out, Tom. And she was awesome. She blew it out of the water. She killed it. She had us rolling on the floor with her sense of humor, but she also engaged us and taught us and educated us about building a more harmonious operation in our fire department, paid or volunteer. She gave great tidbits of information. Didn't matter if it was for a paid department or a volunteer department. It was all about ditching negativity. And this was actually the first class she ever did at FDIC. And as I noted on my class evaluation that I turned in, she needs to come back and keep spreading the message and maybe even expand it into a four-hour class. And speaking of four-hour classes, my four-hour class, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department presentation, went really well. I was so excited. I had a really good, pretty full room of engaged firefighters, and we had a great four-hour discussion. Probably one of the best classes I ever had there. And thank you to everybody that came or talked to me during the conference and after the conference to share your stories and talk to me about professionalism. I talked to so many people at the FDIC conference, which anyone that's been there knows one of the best things about it is the networking as well as the classes. So met so many great people. And again, had a great class. Although I can't explain this, I did have one slide at the very end kind of misfire on me. So everything's going perfect. Presentation's moving right along, building up to the big finish. There's three slides left. I have a slide with a photo of a firehouse. I talk about how the firehouse in every community stands as a beacon of hope and strength. Underneath the picture, it says a beacon of hope and strength. I click the clicker to advance the slide. The firehouse pops up on the screen in the writing. A beacon of hope and strength is in Russian. It was in Russian. No one can explain it to me. The audience is looking at me like, is there a joke here? And I looked at them and said, I can't explain what just happened. I can tell you it's supposed to say in English, a beacon of strength and hope. And then it crashed on me and I brought the program back up. No big deal. Sometimes PowerPoint shuts down. I brought it back up and it was back in English. Nobody can explain that to me. Everyone's teasing me saying I was hacked, but these are the things sometimes that can happen when you're doing a live presentation. Yeah. And I also forgot, or actually didn't forget, but forgot my shoes. I didn't have a backup pair of shoes and my dress shoes that you wear. When you do these presentations at FDIC, you dress in a suit. And my shoes, as I was putting them on, my foot went through the bottom of my shoe. So Tom Merrill was up there dressed professionally in a beautiful suit and sneakers. What are you going to do? My wife told me that's what the young 20-something-year-olds are doing now. So I called myself a trendy 58-year-old trending guy. You know, I was wearing sneakers. It was very comfortable, I got to tell you that. But other than that, my presentation went really, really well. And everything aside, it was another absolutely amazing FDIC experience. So I'd really like to thank Chief Bobby Halton and Diane and Ginger and all the great people at Clarion Events and Fire Engineering who were involved with FDIC and provided me with the invitation to come back and again present. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And again, it was so great to see so many old friends, meet some of the new friends as well. Went to dinner one night with Chiefs Lasky and Salka. And I think most of you listeners are certainly familiar with these two great fire service leaders. You know, they've been teaching for generations now and written so many articles and also have great podcasts. I call them the rock stars of our business. They're the A-listers in our industry because of the impact they have and can have had and continue to have. But anyway, went to dinner with the Chief Lasky and Chief Salka, and Chief Lasky brought two firefighters from his volunteer fire department, the Wichita West Volunteer Fire Department, which is in Texas. And folks, you might not be aware that Chief Lasky is now serving proudly as a volunteer there in his hometown. So accompanying Chief Lasky was the chief of the Wichita West Volunteer Fire Department, Ryan Fetzer, and a captain, Chris Bashford. And you know, I was introduced to them, and it was great to sit and talk with them and share experiences and stories and compare notes about how we do things back home and how we do things in, you know, our respective departments. And folks, that's one, again, one of the most amazing things about FDIC, and that's the networking and the ability to connect and share stories with so many other firefighters, so many like-minded firefighters. Fighters from all over, not just the United States, but the world, you know. And you know what? They're all true professionals, true, for sure. You know, it's not only the rock stars like Chief Lasky and Salka that you can meet and talk with and get advice from and share some fun times with at these events. There's thousands of regular boots on the ground firefighters as well, all there to learn, all there to perfect this craft just a little bit better and bring some ideas and knowledge back to their hometown fire departments. And again, doesn't matter if it's staffed by career personnel or volunteers or any combination of that. They're all there for one common purpose, and that's to gain more knowledge. And that, my friends, is one of the trademarks of a true professional. And I can tell you that after meeting these new acquaintances, you have a friend for life now. Every time I come back to FDIC, I tell my wife I just made like 100 new friends. And after you meet them, you see them walking around the trade show floor or in a class or out in the hallways outside the classrooms, and you smile and you nod and you start talking with them again, even a year or two later. You exchange business cards and you contact information and you stay in touch with people through the year. And again, the next year, you see them again and you pick off where you last left off. And then you meet even new friends. It's a freaking awesome experience. And it was that way this year as well, albeit a little different maybe with the pandemic and some of the changes that brought. But it was still a great FDIC experience nonetheless. And I can't say enough about it. And if you've never been, I encourage you to try and get there next year, which I believe it's going to be at the end of April, April 25th to the 30th for FDIC 2022. So nice to meet so many new friends, especially Chief Fetzer and Captain Bashford from the Wichita West Volunteer Fire Department in the great state of Texas. I look forward to seeing them next year as well, because I know they're now hooked. They plan on being there. And folks, from the minute I met these two firefighters, I could tell that they are definitely two true professional volunteer firefighters serving in a professional volunteer fire department. One other note of interest I wanted to share with you today. How does a free education sound to anybody out there that maybe is looking to further their education? Well, I just want to make you aware, our friends at the National Volunteer Fire Council, they have teamed up with Columbia Southern University, and they're offering scholarship opportunities to National Volunteer Fire Council members. This is the 13th year they've done it, and they're going to provide these scholarships for up to 60 credit hours toward any one of the many online degree programs they have. And they offer a wide range of accredited degree programs, including fire science and fire administration and safety and health programs and so many more. So scholarship recipients can get an associate, bachelor's, or a master's degree. To be eligible, you just got to be a member of the National Volunteer Fire Council and a volunteer responder. So if you want to look into that, for more information or to apply, head over to nvfc.org, and you're going to see links there on their homepage that will take you to the site for more information. The only thing is, the deadline is fast approaching. I think it's August 25th, so act now. Now, on this episode of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, I'm going to tackle a very important subject and examine a very interesting approach to dealing with this subject matter. And it's a subject that is important to firefighters everywhere, career or volunteer, and that is firefighter rehabilitation at incidents. And you know, as firefighters, we are so focused on helping others, but who really watches out for us while we're at the scene? Of course, we may understand that there may be a need for proper rehab at emergency incidents, but show me the firefighter who maybe doesn't push the envelope a little bit or drop their gear, but put it back on immediately when they're asked to do something else. And then they don't even know it, but all of a sudden they've not only gone through two bottles, but maybe three or four or even more. So who's there to watch over them and maybe remind them to get the rest in the rehab that they need? So I want to hear tonight from a specialized unit that's dedicated to rehab, a unit that is composed of all volunteer members and committed to delivering professional service to their local first responders. In fact, it's right there in their tagline, professionally operated by volunteers. I love that. Folks, I'm talking about the Metro Richmond Flying Squad, and I love their tagline, we are there when they need us. So joining me to talk about this unique unit, the specialized unit, and the services they provide, and the importance of rehab, is their Chief Steve Korb, who's a third-generation firefighter and began as a volunteer back in the 70s, I believe. Sorry, Steve, but I'm going to bring him on the show right now and let him introduce himself a little bit. Welcome to the show, buddy.
Good morning, Chief. Thank you so much for having me this morning. This is my first podcast. If I happen to start speaking in Russian, then we got hacked.
Then I have been hacked. No one can explain that. Maybe the IT guy you got working with you can explain it, but I can't. So yes, thanks for being here. I really appreciate your time. And I know you're so passionate about what we're going to talk about tonight. And before we get into that, why don't you just introduce yourself? Tell people a little bit about you, your involvement with the fire service. I think you were career and volunteer. And so in third generation, I think, right?
Yeah, Chief, my grandfather started. He was a career firefighter in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he began in 1918. So he actually had the privilege of hooking up the horses and responding on that horse-drawn apparatus that we all like to watch at musters today. My father exposed me to the volunteer service in my hometown, just outside Cincinnati. He became a volunteer when we moved out into the suburbs. He rose up to the ranks of assistant chief. I remember at 12 years old, I'd ride my bicycle and show up at his scenes and help them roll hose when it was over with. And it really exposed me. After school, we would go to the firehouse and hang out. And it just exposed me to just the wonderful aspects of the volunteer fire service and what an integral function it is. And it's really part of the community. you know, having the festivals, things like that. I decided at that age, I want to actually get paid for this. And I'm still going to be a volunteer, but a paycheck wouldn't hurt too. So I started making my applications and was hired with a smaller department up in Ohio near Cincinnati in 1980. So that's when my career began. Did 2 years there. Then I decided, you know what? I was sitting on I might date myself here, but the old Keenan Loop. I don't even know if we still teach that, but we were at a tanker fire one night. It was literally 22 below zero, sitting on a Keenan Loop, spraying water on some tankers that were on fire. And I said, you know what? I love being a firefighter, but being cold like this is a little too much. So I started putting in applications all up and down the East Coast, from about the Mid-Atlantic all the way down to Florida. And I at that point, I decided I want to be a career firefighter in a warm climate. So the city of Richmond here in Virginia, we're the capital of Virginia, hired me in 1984, came here, went through the academy, went through probationary, all that, was assigned to the busiest firehouse in the city, which is Engine Company 5. Back then it was called Truck 41. Now it's that company's actually been disbanded, but it still is the busiest company here in the city. I was here a couple of years. I was on the list in Miami Beach, Florida. They called me. It was the middle of winter. I was doing a side job, putting roofs on the houses. And I said, you know what, let me head down to South Florida and continue this career. So I ended up spending 26 years there, retired back in 2010, enjoyed every minute of it. When I retired, I had decided to move back to the Mid-Atlantic and relocated back here to Richmond, Virginia.
Nice. And, you know, like so many people in the profession, career, volunteer, both, you got hooked as a kid. That's just Absolutely. Awesome. I love it. You're rolling hose and, you know, the fire service bug bit you and you were hooked and been involved ever since, which is, you know,
my poor mother was the old plectrons would go off in the middle of the night and the things she put up with the house siren going off. And back in the early days, we just had the plectron and a house siren. We would write the address of the incident we were going to on a chalkboard, hang it in front of the firehouse. So if other members showed up late when the apparatus was gone, they knew where to go. So times sure have changed and they certainly have evolved.
That's true. Thing we've come a long way, and you know, you're to be commended for still staying so involved. I mean, you've got quite the experience there between the volunteer and paid, and up and down the East Coast. And I think it's awesome too. Do you got any great photos from your grandpa from 1918? Because World War I's just ending, and they got horses still, and that's incredible.
I do have a few. I'm a big history buff, especially within the fire service. I've probably got 10 albums at home. My dad has a whole file at home. And anytime I go back home to Cincinnati, we'll always swing by a disbanded old firehouse and just walk around. And sometimes we'll just sit there and think, wow, all the things that went on in this firehouse. That's special to me.
If the walls could only talk, right? For sure.
Absolutely.
So before we talk about this unit that you helped found, I want to talk about the importance of rehab first. You know, back in the day, I remember at any fire I went to, I joined in 1982, and all through the 80s, when we had a working fire afterwards, we were, you know, downing a Pepsi or a Coca-Cola. We even used to smoke cigars at the scene of what we called a good fire. I saw an interview you did on the local news recently where you talked about firefighters going at it like a professional athlete, right? You're going from 0 to 100 in you know, 1/10 of a second. But on the firefighter side of thing, there's really no warning that you're going maybe from sitting or sleeping, boom, and you know, you're right into it. So I want to talk about the importance of this health and safety for our members. And, you know, we got to get our members not to view it as punishment, because I think sometimes it can be viewed as punishment if we tell people to slow down afterwards and go through some proper rehab. So I think we need to change the mindset, right? And get people to understand the importance of firefighter rehab, right?
Absolutely. What you just mentioned, our bodies really, they're just not designed for a continuous, intense level of work that is being done during interior firefighter operations. So really rehab is it's all about recovery. It's just a period of time to come into the area and allow your body to get back to some normal limits. Let it cool down, let your heart rates slow down a little bit, get back to normal. It's not a punishment of any kind. And we always stress that. What our goal is to get you back into prime physical condition so that you can go back into that fire, but go back into it healthy and safe and go home healthy and safe and continue on and enjoy the rest of your life as healthy and safe. That's the main function of this.
Boy, it's a great goal. It certainly is. I mean, 50%, right, of all line of duty firefighter deaths are, I think, due to stress and overexertion. And there's actually a, I think it was the last stats were 2019, over 60 line of duty firefighter deaths, and 30 something were due to heart attacks. So it's something to be concerned with. And I think there's an NFPA standard as well on rehabilitation. I think it's the NFPA 1584 standard. So a lot of information out there. And it's certainly the first thing is awareness. We got to get our members to be aware that we're losing firefighters every year due to overexertion and stress. We're losing firefighters due to cardiac events, and rehab can help limit or cut down on the number of injuries and deaths on the fire ground. So what happens to our body at these fire and emergency scenes? What's going on? Why are we having these issues and firefighters having cardiac events and overexertion? What's going on?
I always like to start with the big picture, that 100-yard look at what's going on. Your blood consists of, it's half of your blood volume is plasma. And without getting super technical, but plasma is the yellow mixture. It contains water, protein, salt, enzymes, and that's what carries the blood cells and the nutrients to the rest of your body. And it's that liquid portion of the blood. And then plasma itself, let's break it down a little further. Plasma is 90% water. So when we work, what happens is our muscles begin to create heat. Our brain senses this, begins the sweating process. That's the natural process. You and I out in our shorts and t-shirt on a hot day, we'll sweat, you know, and the evaporation process allows that heat to leave the body, which allows your core temperature to come down to with the normal limits. So now as firefighters, what are we wearing? We've got full PPE. You're still sweating. You're working intensely, but now you've lost that mechanism to cool down. That sweat is trapped within your gear. You continue to work. So that cycle continues and continues. Your core temperature continues to elevate. You've lost sweat, which is water and salt, which allows your blood become thicker, which can tend, unfortunately, results in a clot, can result in a heart attack, a stroke, and all kinds of other disorders. Our main function and main 100-yard look at this is to break that heating cycle. When the firefighters come into our area, especially on the hot days, first thing, get out of the coat, drop the bunker pants at minimum down to the ankles, sit down in an area. When we pull up on a scene, the first thing I'm looking for and our members are looking for is a natural shaded area. Today here in Richmond, it's about 90 degrees, probably going to have a heat index of 98 in a couple of hours. Natural shade, we have the bright sun shining. If today, let's just say today's 90 degrees with bright sun, add 10 degrees. So now we're at 100. Put full protective gear on, add another 10 degrees. So they're working in an environment that would realistically be a 110 degree day. Now add the humidity on top of that, and now you get into your heat indexes, which could fast are into the dangerous levels. So the things that can happen, heat cramps, that's when you start losing salt, your muscles start twitching, heat exhaustion is just the next little step. Heat stroke is the most serious. That is the killer.
So you're looking to really cool these people down, first and foremost, get the gear off and get them to cool down and lower maybe that core temperature, right? I think I've read once that the body core temperature is, you really need to monitor that and try and lower that as quick as possible.
That is the main emphasis. Once they get into our area, like I said, if we cannot find a natural shaded area, we have equipment, which is a simple shade canopy that we will deploy to create shade. We have seating, we have misting fans that we can use. The most simple thing is a bucket of cool water with some cooling towels, okay? We give them to the firefighters, they put them on their head, their neck, we'll wrap their arms in them. Sometimes we'll have them put their arms actually in buckets of water. That's a fast, effective way to lower that core temperature. As we talked about the blood part of it, today we all know that the carcinogenic rates are extremely high in firefighters. When your core temperature is elevated, the skin absorption rate is increased by like 400% for every degree of internal. So the quicker we can get that core temperature down, it's multifaceted. It's helping with the replace the volume. It's giving the body a good chance at recovery. Remember in the old days, back in the old day, we would take a shower after a working fire and you would smell smoke. 5 days later, you take another shower and you still smell smoke. I'm like, what is going on? That fire was 5 days ago. That is the toxins being released from the skin.
Wow. That's pretty, pretty graphic way to really illustrate that. I remember blowing my nose after fires, and I thought it was cool. You know, the handkerchief or the Kleenex would be filled with black soot. And, oh, look at this. Isn't this cool? And now we know, you know, just like salt, you know, just like your dirty gear is not a good sign. It's not, you know, a salty firefighter. It's an uneducated firefighter. And I guess it's the same way for, you know, we have to educate people. You know, I heard a great expression that it's not really related to the rehab on scene, but at FDIC this year, one of our Commissioner Griebner, who I talked about earlier, took a class on cancer awareness, and their tagline was shower within the hour, trying to get firefighters to understand when you get back from a working fire, get in that shower within an hour. Yes, wipe down at the scene as best you can with the body wipes and things, but when you get back to the firehouse or get back home, get in the shower.
Absolutely. And when we start talking about timeframes in rehab, when we get into that, we always try to identify an area. We'll put a tarp out where the firefighters can take off their bunker coats, set it in on the tarp. That gear is off gassing while it's sitting there. Remember the old days, you would take your gear into the bunk room with you after a fire. The gear off gasses. And there's that 20 minute, studies have shown after about 20 minutes, a significant portion of those toxins have off gassed already. Wow. So that's one reason we want them out of the gear, plus the cooling mechanism gets them back to normal.
And on the volunteer side of things, that off-gassing, and I've talked about this before, I remember going to even a training drill or a working fire, and in the volunteer side, so many volunteers throw their gear where? In their vehicle. And there it sits, and you're driving around the next day and you can still smell the fire. And now you're not only exposing yourself still, but now you might have family in the car with you or friends in the car with you. So awareness of the off-gassing is huge today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because cancer is it's a tragic statistic. It's claiming the firefighters, you know, it's out of control right now. But
so why don't you walk us through a normal rehab, a working fire or emergency incident that's prolonged and members are in their gear and you show up on scene. What's a good base guideline for proper rehab? Again, I know, I think the standard's NFPA 1584 that can give our listeners some more information, but why don't you walk us through a base rehab assignment that you would do with your crew? What do we want to do with these members? I know you mentioned a little bit about finding a cool area, but what are some of the other things that you do?
Like you said, the NFPA 1584, that is the guideline, and it is a standard now. It started out as a recommendation, so we follow it to the letter of the law. First thing in my mind when we're going to the scene, just like as a firefighter, as you're going to the scene, you're listening to the on-scene radio traffic, you're making a mental picture of what's going on. The first thing is the safest way for our apparatus to approach the scene. We're listening to where the lines are being laid. We're coming in, trying to come up with a little plan on coming in without, we want to be at least obstructive to the active fire ground operation. We're normally there last. It takes about 15, 20 minutes for us to arrive on the scene. Once we pull up, we'll literally do a rehab size up. What type of event are we dealing with? Is this a room and contents where it's going to be an hour and a half event? Or is this a high-rise structure with fire blown out of the fifth floor? We're going to be there several hours. Is this going to be an all-day, sometime possibly an all-week type of an event? So we do a little rehab size up to make sure we have our resources lined up. We'll pull up. The first decision is to locate the area, and it's called site selection. You want to be upwind and uphill from the incident, so there's no water running off into our area. Like I said, in the summer, we're looking for natural shade right off the bat. First thing we're going to deploy is our coolers to get the hydration going. That's the quickest thing we can get out. We carry both bottled water and sports drinks. We will locate it in that shaded area. If we do have natural shaded area, then the next thing is sitting. We don't want our firefighters sitting on the ground or on the curbs. We want them in a nice, comfortable chair. The chairs we use are a bit of a web design so that they allow airflow from both the back and the front, so that when the firefighters come to our area, they can at least sit down, start getting hydrated. We teach all of our members, we don't ask, do you want a bottle of water? We reach out and put it in their hand and smile, and they take it, and they're very thankful. So now they will sit down, they've gotten out of their gear. We have tried to have a controlled access point because there is an accountability component to this. Once they're being hydrated, The first phase is medical monitoring, and everyone thinks, oh, that's blood pressures, heart rates, things like that. It's not. Medical monitoring is our eyes looking at the firefighters and seeing, do they look normal or do they look sick? if they're bent over, if they're beet red, that's part of the medical monitoring. If they're not making sense when they're talking, if they happen to vomit, that's an immediate red flag to call our paramedics into action. Okay, so the medical monitoring part is mostly visual and just speaking with them. Hey, how you doing? Can I get you anything? The next phase is that generally lasts about 10 minutes initially. And then because every time a firefighter comes in our area, yes, their heart rate's going to be top, way up there. Their blood pressure is going to be high. Their respiratory rate's going to be high. They're going to be look tired. That's normal. That's a normal tired. You get to learn what is normal tired and what's not normal tired. Okay. So after about 10 minutes, the paramedics here in Richmond will start doing the medical evaluation part. And the easy way to remember that in NFPA, you know, I don't get into all the technicalities. We follow it by the letter, but medical evaluation, the E is an EMS function. So they're now getting in doing the heart rates, the SAT levels on the blood, the EKGs, things like that. And they have their parameters that they follow as far as what are their benchmarks before that firefighter is cleared to be released from our area and go back and be assigned either to go back into the fire or to be returned to service. If that firefighter does not meet that criteria, then they're going to stay a little bit longer. Generally, it's about a 20-minute period. Now, there are going to be some incidents where the incident commander needs their firefighters back quicker, and other companies may not be on the scene yet. So that's sometimes that is a variable, but they are cleared medically before they do go back in. Now, that scenario I call structure, or I call formal rehab. It can also be as informal as a firefighter walking over to the shade area, having a seat, give them a glass of water, sit down and chat with them for a while. They're all just taking a break. So there are, rehab does not have to be always the full Monty, as I say.
Right.
It can be as simple as sitting on a tailboard in the shade and rehydrating.
And getting the bunker gear off maybe and letting the cool down a little bit, right? Absolutely. And I did hear too that, you know, with a little bit of my take on the medical from what I heard, again, I mentioned earlier, is I know some agencies do temperature checks because oral temperature, from what I read, can be a good indicator of what your core temperature is and if there's good blood flow. But that doesn't always work, especially in colder weather like where I am. But I did hear that. I do know some units do that in their medical monitoring or evaluation station. I'm not sure which station would do that. So I was going to ask you, so do you have medics right with you then? Are they pretty close to where you set up? Do you usually have a medic crew right by you?
Yes, Chief. When we pull in, we try to look for the ambulance. Here in Richmond, it's called the Richmond Ambulance Authority. We will team up with them. They are dispatched on all box alarms, all working fire reports of. We will team up with them. They do all the medical evaluation part. They do the tympanic temperature where they do the ear. So they check that. They check all the vitals. And backing up just a little bit, the placement of the vehicles, you always want to make sure that that medic unit has a way out if something happens where a firefighter needs immediate transportation. Again, back to that site selection and placing the apparatus is very important.
You ever get firefighters say, I'm hungry, give me some food? Do you guys bring any snacks? Or
we do. That's about the step four. Once we have them in a cool spot, once we have them hydrated, once we medically monitored them and evaluated them, we'll put out our luscious snack table. We have peanuts, crackers. We try to stick with mostly heart healthy snacks. We have some gluten-free snacks. We have fruit juice. We have actually individual packets of tuna salad and chicken salad that have a shelf life of about a year and a half. They're very popular. And some of the firefighters will actually take one and put it in their bunker gear because at 3 a.m., the next medical call or stuck elevator they're running on, they might be hungry and we're not there. So it's been real popular. Let's see. Yeah, we will set up a snack table. In the wintertime, we will we were equipped with some Brunswick stew that we can heat up for longer duration events. Our truck has a microwave on board. So the main things with the rehab is the core temperature stabilization, the hydration, taking care of their nutrition, the accountability part, the medical aspect of it, and then releasing them back healthy, ready to go again.
That's great. And another thing I was just thinking of with the medical too, I remember again, when we were putting our rehab SOP, SOG, whatever you call it, together years ago, they really focus too on blood pressure. You know, obviously it's going to be high when firefighters come out of the fire, but after the rest period, if the blood pressure or systolic was above 160 or the diastolic above 100, The recommendation was that they don't release them. And I know that's more of a medical call, but do you guys have, is there any baselines on that? Do you know that your medical people are looking for with the blood pressure?
They have a flow sheet that they follow. I don't know the exact parameter that since they handle that here. We are under the direction of, in Richmond, we fall under the direction of the safety officer. So safety officer is always on scene. He's a battalion, he or she's a battalion chief level officer. So they are considered the rehab manager. As far as rehab has its own ICS set up too. You have the rehab manager supervising the entire operation. Then you have the medical group and then our group.
Gotcha. And are you monitoring people for how often they've been at rehab? Are they coming in after every bottle? And is there
generally speaking on the formal side of rehab, when the incident commander is in charge, as we know, of the entire incident, the incident commander will assign, okay, engine five, report to rehab. Then the accountability process takes place. There's a transfer of accountability. We assign our own accountability officer, because just once they come out of the fire, something could happen between the time they get from the fire to our area. If something went on, some type of an explosion, building collapse, whatever, they need to know so-and-so command to rehab, who do you have in your sector to account if someone happened to be missing. So there is accountability component. Yes, sir.
Gotcha. What happens then when they go back in? Is they're limited then with how many times they can come back into the fire environment? Because I know with us, it's after two bottles, you really got to, you got to be watched. So is that an incident commander's decision then, with along with the safety officer, you were saying?
Yes, it is up to incident command and safety. NFPA does identify a certain bottle threshold. We get a little more aggressive with that. If you're in there working, you should come at least cycle through rehab, either formally or informally at some point, and that the incident commander is in charge of that. But there is no limit. Our longest incident so far lasted about 16 hours. And it began as formal rehab for about the first 3 or 4 hours. It was a multiple alarm fire. And then it transitioned into simply informal, where the firefighters are coming out. They know where the coolers are. They know where the snacks are. And they will find us and take care of themselves at that point. But we are still an extra set of eyes watching them, watching how they're walking. Are they complaining of anything? On our table, we put out a set of ibuprofen, Tylenol, things like that. And when I see a firefighter, and I instruct all of our members, when a firefighter asks for that or reaches out for it, I'll ask them, hey, you had a headache all day, or did it just happen? A lot of times they'll be, no, every time I have a fire, I'll get a headache. Headaches, as we know, it could be a key symptom of carbon monoxide poisoning. Mm.
So. Yeah. And how many times, I remember, I think it's Chief Gary Ludwig, who was the chief of the International Association of Fire Chiefs, I believe, a couple of years ago, but they had an expression that he introduced: if you don't feel well, say something, or something like that. It's the bottom line is, how many firefighter line of duty deaths have occurred and were prefaced with the firefighter coming out of an incident and just not feeling well, and people saying, I'll go lay down, and they check on him hours later and he's passed away. So I think what you're saying is so important. It's the awareness of how members are acting, what they're saying, how they look. And you're an extra, like you said, a perfect extra set of eyes and ears for that.
Exactly what you said. And rehab continues to go on once you're back at the firehouse or back home. If you're a career fire department or you're volunteer on a duty crew, you know your fellow firefighter better than anybody. If they're not acting right, talk to them. If he's like, oh, I don't feel good, bring it to someone's attention. There's something in this. They're doing studies on it. There's something about that first 24-hour window after an incident. There's so many NFPA stories out there where the firefighter goes home and is tired. They've been working all night at a fire and they suffer some type of medical emergency and pass on. That's just a tragic statistic. That
right. Rehab doesn't stop when you pick up from the incident. And that includes hydration too. So we get back to the firehouse. Maybe we should avoid that pot of coffee right away and continue to hydrate.
Hydration should actually begin the first thing in the morning. Most of us walk around in a pretty well normal state of hydration, but it definitely start early, because to play catch up on hydration is very hard. You could lose up to a liter or two of volume working intensely at any fire. So pre-hydrating, hydrating during the fire, and then post-hydration. And there is, you have to be careful. You do not want to over-hydrate. A lot of people, there's been some studies out, I'll just check the color of your urine. If it's clear, you're good. Well, that's not so. You could be overhydrating, which is not good. Also, it should be like about a light straw yellow color. Mm-hmm. If it's dark brown, you're definitely dehydrated, and your body's going to tell you that. If you're thirsty, then you should hydrate.
I know some fire companies that keep water on the rigs, and they're downing a bottle of bottled water on the way to an incident just to hydrate on the way to the call. I've heard of
that's an excellent idea. We try to leave a case of some water with the crews, and a lot of them have coolers themselves. But you have to be careful. You don't want to, like I said, you don't want to overhydrate. Right. Your stomach can only process, because water is absorbed. It's not digested. So it's absorbed in the stomach. So if you have too much in there and you start working hard again, it could create some issues, nausea.
Be a little aware there, but it might not be a bad idea to keep a bottle of water. I've seen them in cup holders, cup holders next to the jump seats on some of the apparatus. And I guess that's an awareness thing. If you know you've been hydrating during the day, of course, you might not need it on the way to that incident. But it also serves as a reminder to the firefighter that maybe came in, drank coffee at the start of the shift, or when he came down to the firehouse, hey, you know what? I better drink some water. I haven't had much today. So absolutely, a great reminder of that.
I read a recent study where the hydration part, we all know the importance of that. It helps you if you are consuming some kind of a salty snack at the same time. Because remember, we said water and salt are in the sweat. You can lick your arm when you're sweaty. It's salty. Right. Well, right. We carry salty pretzels, drinking water, eating some salty pretzels. That combination has done a lot of benefits to replenish that salt. So don't be too fearful. That
because pretzels are my kryptonite, and my A1C is rising a little bit, and and pretzels are a carbohydrate, so she's all worried about it. So I'm going to tell her Steve Corbs that I can eat pretzels.
There you go. I'll send you a note, Chief.
Now, this isn't just fires and emergency scenes, right? Rehab is also important to think about. Hey, if firefighters are out training and drilling, like you said, 90 degrees today, they're going to go out of the firehouse and do some training and drilling. Does maybe have to be the formal rehab, but it's something to be aware of. They better worry about rehab.
Absolutely. The training part is, we support all the Richmond firefighters when they go through their basic drill school, when they're doing their live burns or they're doing their extrication class. That's a good opportunity for us to interact with the new recruits and start them out with so that they understand that it's not a timeout. You're not being punished. We want you to go home safe. We want you to retire and live to be 100 years old. That's a good opportunity to start at the beginning, because there is some mindset still out there. Oh, we didn't need this. You didn't need it, but man. Yeah, you do need it.
People that say we don't need SCBA or protective hoods and that type of stuff.
And here in Richmond, we're getting into doing some duty crews. So if we hear a natural gas leak where they're out evacuating patient or people, and it's a working incident, we will swing by and hydrate them while we're out and about.
So tell me about this Metro Flying Squad. I think it just started a few years ago, right? So why don't you talk about it. I love what you said. I know you did a recent interview on the newscast I happened to catch, and I'm going to put a link for that up on my site when the show's finished. But I think you said something like, once you're a firefighter, you're always a firefighter, and it's your way of giving back to the men and women that are still on the job. So tell us a little bit about this Metro Richmond Flying Squad and how it came to be, and what you're doing in your area, because you're doing some good stuff.
It's really taken off. I retired in 2010. Can only ride a motorcycle and hike in the mountains so long. And I miss the fire department. I miss being part of the fire service. When you start out at a young age, it's part of you for the rest of your life. So I'm living in Richmond, and it's a career department. I'm thinking, I started talking to some of my former classmates. I said, what do you all do for support? Who comes to help you with, drinks and snacks, things like that. And they really didn't have a formal group that does it. They do have an air light truck that comes out with a cooler and some limited snacks, things like that. But they're mostly concentrating with filling bottles. So I started talking to some of my friends that were retired firefighters at the time, running the idea by them. And we had some interest. So we started it in 2017. I approached the City of Richmond fire chief, who at the time was Chief Daniels. His only question to me was, when can you be operational? this was around Christmas Eve, I believe, of 2016. We went operational in April. Now, once you have approval to do something, it takes a little bit of funding to get this going. So we needed to identify some funding. So my next step, I think it was New Year's Day, I reached out to our local group. It's the Richmond Fire Department Foundation. They're the nonprofit foundation that helps firefighters and their families. And I set up a meeting with their board of directors. We discussed the concept and it was immediately totally agreed on, and they provided the money to get us started. We started with a donated vehicle, outfitted it with all the equipment according to the NFPA needs, and we were operational. When the chief asked, when can you be operational? This was back in December. I said, May 1st. I had no idea if we could even pull this off. May 1st. And we went operational April 30th. So we were one day ahead of time, and we actually came in under budget. So,
oh, that's great. That's great.
Tell us a little bit about the Richmond Fire Department, by the way. A fully paid department, right?
Yes, sir. It's the sixth oldest paid fire department in the country. Began being a career department in 1858.
Wow.
I don't have the exact date, but it started as all the older cities in the country started as volunteer, like in the mid to late 1700s. So there's a steep history here in Richmond. They became a paid department in 1858. It's all career. It's about 550 uniformed personnel running out of 20 firehouses and 25 fire companies. They run about, I'd say roughly around 200 working fires per year, probably another couple hundred working incidents. And the way the city's divided, we have the James River, which flows right through the middle of the city that divides north and south. James River has some class 3 and 4 rapids, so it's popular with kayakers. We have a really amazing, aggressive water rescue team. Any weekend when it's warm out, the water rescue team can expect to be out on the river rescuing people off of rocks, people that get stranded, kayakers that get in trouble. And the water rescues, we do support those also. We don't go out on the river. We don't have boats. But what we'll do then is we'll stage where the launch points are, where the boats go in the water.
I'm just curious because I'm a fire buff and I love to learn about different departments. And just slightly off topic, do you know what their manning is on the rigs? How many personnel are on pumpers and ladders?
Yes, sir. City of Richmond does 4 and 4.
Oh, that's great.
Four on both the engines and the truck companies. We have specialized units, hazmat unit, 2 technical rescue teams, 3 water rescue teams, 4 battalions, safety officer. They're part of the regional technical rescue team, which consists of, you know, the city plus all the regional counties in the area. So very aggressive department. They support us 100%.
Do they do, and this would be important for rehab too, and it's, they do 24-hour shifts where they, you know, fatigue could enter into it, or do you know?
Absolutely. They have a schedule. It rotates one on, one off, one on, one off. They do, there's a different cycle. Then they build in some 4-day breaks and some 5-day breaks.
But they're doing 24 straights?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Yeah. So that's something to be too.
They run first response on medical calls, as we know. 80-90% of the runs now. In Richmond, they have the Richmond Ambulance Authority. That is the primary paramedic advanced life support unit. But our fire companies are very busy running first response.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And I know, back to the flying squad, where's the name come from? The Metro Flying Squad. That is such a cool name. And there's got to be a history with that.
Oh, yeah. I can credit retired fire captain John Hynett. He's our historian. We have some history books out there. I've got them all. The original flying squad was formed back in June in 1965. And I actually have the time at 1727. It went into service. It ran out of firehouse. That's one.
Some good record keeping there.
And if I got that time wrong, Captain Hynett would be on the phone when this is over.
Okay.
It started with Captain Longst. It was a 9-man company back then, primarily a manpower squad. There were 2 shifts back then. One was led by Lieutenant Birch. The other was Lieutenant Pemberton. Their main assignment, their run assignments, they were based on the potential for large loss fires. The high occupancy stuff, they were automatics on all multiple alarms. Now that was Flying Squad 1. At some point, the city started annexing parts of the southern south of the James River. So they felt a need. They put in Flying Squad 2, went into service. So that was in 1970. Same setup, went on multiple alarm fires. They reported directly to the fire chief. The fire chief picked that crew. It was kind of a prelude to the current rescue companies that we see today. So the actual Flying Squad name was disbanded back in 1981, and it morphed into, then it was called the Tactical Squads. So that one TAC squad would be in charge of the water rescues. One had hazmat. One had technical rescues.
Gotcha.
And then the tactical squads, I'm not exactly sure of the date. Sorry, Captain Hynett, but they turned into the rescue companies that we see today.
What a great way to honor the history, the name, the heritage of that unit. And I bet you anyone that was associated with those squads is so excited to see that name carry on.
Absolutely. Lieutenant Birch, who was one of the original, he's passed on, but his son was a chief out in Roanoke County in Virginia. He visits all the time. Him and his sister came to the firehouse one day, and I presented him with a ARC version of the Flying Squad t-shirt, and his sister just became emotional, and she's like, you don't know how important this is to us. So when we finally start doing our full renovation on the firehouse that we are purchasing, we're going to dedicate a space to the history of that Flying Squad. They deserve that.
That's phenomenal. God bless. That is just awesome to hear. So when you did start out, though, were there some naysayers? Was there any opposition? Anyone that I know you mentioned some people are of, we don't need this, but did you have any? It doesn't sound like you had much of a pushback. I mean, the chief was certainly open, welcomed you with open arms, right? How did that go?
Yeah, the naysayers, they were just the old school. Ah, we didn't need this. I'm like, yeah, you're right. But maybe you did need it and you just didn't know it. So,
right.
But very little opposition, really no opposition. The fire administration was completely on board. I guess the first few months, the battalion chiefs and the safety officers really didn't know when to call, when not to call. So we kind of went through that learning curve. It's a learning curve on both parts.
Sure.
So, but yeah, I was amazed at the speed and the support that we received from everybody.
That's great. And I know you guys are busy. I took a look at your run log on your website. And I mean, you're going out very on a really regular basis, which, again, you even indicated that, you're like a volunteer fire department. Looking at the run log. Yeah, you are. You are going out. This isn't just once in a while. You're going out regularly. So and I know once you did mention that you are run like a volunteer fire department, right?
Absolutely. When it first started off, Chief, we were an automatic on all second alarms and available to be special called by the commanders. Well, as we all know, the old days are slowing down. We don't have the big multiple alarm fires, the frequency that we used to. But why shouldn't a firefighter be treated with the same type of support at a room and contents fire? They're still working. They're still laying large diameter hose. They're still rescuing people out of buildings. They deserve the best. So we started ramping up. I think year one, we ran around 20 calls. Next year was 30. The year after was 30. Then last year we hit 50. And this year, we're at 98. So we're fast approaching that 100th level, which is a milestone for us. Mm-hmm. And I can anticipate based on the trends we're seeing, we'll end up this year around 150 calls.
Wow. All right. And you're all volunteer, right? 100%.
100% volunteer. Yes, sir.
On call 24/7.
Absolutely. Got the phone apps. We use the I Am Responding. You know, there's different phone apps out there.
I was going to ask you to alert the members.
Yes, it's tied into the fire dispatch CAD center. So it passes right through to us. We're able to mark, are we responding to the station? Are we responding to the scene? We have our policies. You can go POV to the scene within, as long as you follow our policy.
Right.
And we have a station located. And most of our members live about 15 minutes from the station.
Tell us about your station. That's interesting, right? Piece of history right there.
It is exciting.
I got to get down there and see that.
It is so exciting. It was built, it went active in 1917. It was the last firehouse that was designed to house horse-drawn equipment. It was on the south side of the city when they began annexing this area. It's in an area called Woodland Heights. It's a historic designated area. That's was in service from 1917 until about 2012, I believe. Then they relocated to the new station 17. Sat dormant for a while. Department of Public Works used it for a while. We are in the process. It's under contract with the city. We're just in the final phases. We expect to take full ownership around October and November of this year. Prior to that, well, when we first started, the first donated truck sat in the parking lot at Station 10. They didn't know who we were. It's all a learning curve for everybody. Mm-hmm. After about a year, Lieutenant Chase over at Station 18 said, hey, I've got some base space available in our firehouse. Would you like it? I said, I'll be there in 10 minutes. So we housed our truck at Station 18 for a while. The crews were more than happy that we were there. When this became available, we've been going through that process for about 3 years now, about 2.5 years to take ownership, which this will allow us to have our own meeting space. We will have our own bunk space, kitchen. It will be our firehouse, our headquarters.
That's awesome. And so like a volunteer fire department, you have a firehouse. I imagine, like you just said, you have meetings. You have SOPs, SOGs, you got equipment you have to look over and understand. And what other types of things do you guys do at that fire? So do you have regular drills? Are you guys training on the equipment net and have regular training drills?
Absolutely. The last Monday of every month is our training/meeting night. So depending on what's going on, if we have to relay information, we'll have a business meeting. Training wise, we're going to be familiarization with the equipment. We have an onboard generator, so we're dealing with electrical deliverance. We have an apparatus. It's a wheel coach. It looks like an ambulance. It was bought from, it was a fire police vehicle. For those familiar with the fire police operations, has an onboard bathroom. So we just go over all the systems. If a new policy comes out, we'll discuss it to make sure that everyone is clear. We're always stressing safety. I always tell our members, we have 30 members and we have 30 safety officers. I want to keep our eyes on the scene. As we all know, fire scenes are constantly changing. It's a dynamic situation. There's a lot of things going on. We're out in the roadways, we're on the interstates. So we will just go over procedures, policies, things like that. Yes,
sir. And like a volunteer fire department, you have a training officer?
Yes, we do. One of my lieutenants, Greg Neiman, is my training officer. Yes, sir. We use ranks. The rank structure of chief, assistant chief is like the fire department. Some groups like ours, there's about 60 in the country. They'll use president or vice president. Neither one is right or wrong. We just chose to go with the ranks because we are on fire incidents and police incidents, and those officers are familiar with the rank system. They may not be sure is a treasurer ahead of the secretary, but they know what a lieutenant, what a captain, sure. What a chief.
That makes perfect sense. That's a great, great point there. Now, can anyone volunteer? Do you have certain criteria for bringing members into your organization? Again, similar to a volunteer fire department, right? You have to recruit volunteers. So what are you looking for? Do you have to have minimum standards of anything? Do you have to have been a firefighter?
No special requirements other than one big one, and that's have a heart of a volunteer. You want to be able to come out and be a volunteer. 18 years of age on the technical side of it. You have to be 18 years of age. We go through a background check. We do a DMV driver record report. It's a three-phase process. The first phase is strictly the application, where my recruitment and retention committee processes the initial application. They check their references, all that stuff. The background check comes in. Then they proceed over to phase one, where they're invited to attend our scheduled events. They're not allowed to come on actual emergency incidents yet, but they're allowed to come to our scheduled events. Sometimes we'll be out doing a public relation event or a fundraising event. That gives the applicant a chance to get familiar with us. It gives us a chance to get familiar with them to see if this is that perfect fit. Hmm. Once they complete phase one, that generally takes about 30 days. Phase two, now they are allowed to respond to scenes after they get checked off by their officer. And that continues. We want to see how they operate at a scene. Now they're technically a guest, but they've passed all the requirements. They're familiar with the equipment. They can function as a helper on the scene. And then once their officer or the officer of that incident checks them off on three incidents, we want to see, can they move the equipment okay? I mean, we don't deal with a lot of heavy stuff, but a cooler full of ice, that's some weight to it. Mm-hmm. How do they navigate around a scene when you're getting over large diameter hose and all the things that are going on? The professionalism side, we stress that enormously. We want to see, do they have that? Are they acting as the professional that, yes. And then after that phase, then they get into a probationary period, which lasts 9 months. And now they have full response privileges. They're continuing to be evaluated. If we see any weaknesses, we will address that with them one-on-one to get them up to speed. We want them all to be a part of this. And then after the 9 month, they're presented as a vote, and we present them their badge and their flying squad wings. And we transition, like I said, being a new organization, we started out, hey, just show up at two events and we'll vote you in. Well, that we revamped that. As we know, we want our members to have a skin in the game. We want them to feel that they've earned the privilege to be a flying squad member. That's why we have kind of revamped our system, and it's been working well. So that day, that's one of my happy days when I present a new member and can hand them their badge and their flying swing wings and welcome aboard.
I was going to say that's really cool. That's got to be a really good source of pride for them to earn the flying squad wings. I would imagine that's a big deal for them.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah.
How many members you have?
Currently, right now, we have 26 on the books, and we've got about 8 members now in the application phase.
And just like a volunteer fire department with the probationary period, watching over them, educating them, training them, very similar. Do they have like minimum requirements? They have to make so many calls or so many training drills, or is it understanding they're volunteer? What do you gauge on that? Right. What do you hold them responsible for on that?
Currently, our bylaws outline that they can't miss more than about 3 or 4 per year. If they have to miss it due to work or travel or family, just touch base with us. We just didn't want a member to come on and we never hear from them again. You know, at some point it's like, are you a member or not? As far as minimum call volume, we have no requirement for that right now. We are exploring to take this to the next level. We're establishing some duty crews where the members are actually going to staff in the station. We have our Tuesday duty crew, which is myself, Andrew, Matt, and Calvin. And every Tuesday we are at the firehouse and we are staffed for all working fires and working incidents, just like a firehouse. So we're going to start trying to move in that direction. Just like I think it was with a fire department, the citizens are the people that we're supporting. And more volunteer fire departments are even going to duty crew type situations, because the citizens deserve the best treatment that they can get. Well, our customers are our firefighters. And our opinion is those firefighters deserve the best treatment we can get. Because when we're staffed, it really is the only efficient way to deliver this resource efficiently and timely. Because we can be pretty much anywhere in the city. We do not run emergency lights and sirens. We drive regular and we can be there in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So the firefighters are in there doing their thing. We have our area all set up, ready to go, so that when they come out, we welcome them into our area and we go to work.
And like a volunteer firehouse, you have a broad cross section of your community then volunteering, stepping up and volunteering. You got some regular Joe, the automobile mechanic, or Jane, the electrician that step up to do this too.
All walks of life. They come from the career side, volunteer side, business side, retired people, just all walks of life. Yes, sir.
So I know you mentioned earlier the funding was that foundation. Is that still your main source of funding, or are you doing fundraisers, or did you identify other sources of funding?
We're always looking for other areas of funding. We are a subsidiary now of the Richmond Fire Department Foundation. So I report to their board of directors. They are our primary funding avenue. Some firefighters will donate some money on a weekly or monthly basis. The local union here, the IFF 995, generously donates to us. The business community will reach out from time to time. So being a new organization, we don't yet have a true funding or a finance committee formed. We are in the process of that. and we're trying to identify every aspect.
And you have to fix up that firehouse you're in, right? So I imagine that's taking a lot of time and resources and money, right? Because
absolutely
work, didn't it? Absolutely. You had to renovate it quite a bit. I saw you doing drywall work and electrical work, and
we've been doing some little things here and there, just getting started. And this is really exciting. Yes.
And are you required to do a duty shift, or is it only if you're able to? Other people just respond from home.
Right now, you're not required. It's nudge, nudge, encouraged, but it's not required. We do have drivers that sign up to be on call. So that way we know who our primary driver is, because we want to know where the gaps are. We've never missed a call that the Richmond has requested us for, but we do have full discretion to go on any working fire or any working incident that we feel the firefighters can benefit from. So that.
Are you pretty
right now? There is no minimum hour requirement at this point. No.
Are you pretty much at every working fire? I understand, obviously, if the firehouse is staffed, if your house is staffed, it's going to get out. But what if there's no staffing and Richmond gets a working fire? Is there a chance you might not be there? It's just they expect you there every time.
They're probably starting to expect us there.
But we're good now. Yeah.
I don't have the hard statistic in front of my eyes. I would estimate the city has ran about 140 working fires this year, and we turned 98 yesterday. and the day's not over. So we're going to do a little promo thing on our Facebook page when we hit that number 100. That's a milestone for us. And there's other groups. There's a group up in Philadelphia. They're running 780, 800 calls a year. Wow. And we're trying to mimic their program. They've been around 100 years. We've been around 4.5, but they are staffed 24/7. The Philadelphia Second Alarmers run a amazing group up there.
Wow. And then again, are you monitoring the radio? I know you said you use IM responding, but is it just listening to the radio or does the dispatch center make sure they're notifying specifically the Metro Flying Squad? Hey, I don't know if you heard this, but there's a second alarm in progress or even a working fire in progress.
Currently on any second alarm, we are a recommended unit, which is an automatic. So we are notified at that level. We are also notified anytime there is a working fire. And the way our current policy is, any driver can take any working fire. That's totally their discretion. Now, like today, I'll probably be staffed here until it's going to be pretty warm today. We're going to be staffed probably till about 6 o'clock this evening. So we'll have the radio on and monitor and self-activate at that point.
And you roll one vehicle?
Correct. We have two apparatus. We have one primary, which is Rehab 1. We have our original donated vehicle is Rehab 2, which we are actively in the process of getting it up to speed because they have that available as a backup. And there's been several times that we've had multiple fires at one time. So
does Richmond allow you then to get on their radio frequency and respond?
Absolutely. Yes. We'll do is if something came in right now after the podcast, we would mark up on the air, Richmond from Rehab 1, please add us to the XYZ working fire and show us en route. And then they add us into their CAD system. Yes, sir.
Hey, we've been rolling for about an hour here. I just want to remind the listeners that this is Fire Engineering Talk Radio and another installment of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. My guest is Chief Steve Korb, former volunteer firefighter, former career firefighter, retired, talking about the importance of rehab in the unit he helped to found and put together in Richmond, Virginia, the Metro Richmond Flying Squad. Professionally operated by volunteers. This is a great conversation that we're going to continue on with, Chief. You also do some non-traditional things you talk about. It's not just always doing rehab, but you were telling me about some of the other things that you've had to do. So it's not just giving water and taking bunker gear off firefighters and looking over them, is it?
No, we've gotten a couple of times, like about a year or so ago, we were staffed up when it was -5 degrees, which is, that's pretty cold for Richmond. It's probably warm for y'all up in Buffalo, but here in Richmond, 5 below is cold.
It's nothing.
It was a fully involved house. We got on scene at like 3 a.m. and there were about 8 or 9 displaced residents. Now picture this, they're standing out in the snow. It's 5 below 0. They're watching their house burn to the ground, not burn to the ground. Richmond did an aggressive attack and saved it. We set up shade canopies. We have portable heaters because in the winter, everything's different. As we know, we're now not concentrated on the high heat, but the cold. So we're warming them up when they come into the area. So we deployed our tent canopy. We put up sidewalls. We had a kerosene heater in place. Took 9 of the residents, put them inside. Outside was -5. And you'd be surprised that a shade canopy with sidewalls, the interior temperature was 51 degrees with that from -5. So we had 9 displaced residents. We carry blankets. We have what's called a winter warm-up coat, winter warm-up kit that has hats, gloves, things like that. So we're also simultaneously tending to the needs of the displaced residents. And they even had a beagle in there. So we had the beagle, we were getting him some water and playing with him a little bit while we could. And so that happens more in the winter than in the summer, as far as taking care of the citizens. About a month ago, the firefighters went in to do a rescue. They went into rescue mode. And the first thing they pulled out was they found some guinea pigs. They pulled them out. And they brought them over to our rehab area, and our guys and gals were picking glass out of their fur and giving them some water and taking care of them that way. Yeah. We'll support, any event. If someone's having an event, we're doing the 9/11 stair climb this year, which we've done that before. One of the high rises downtown puts that on. We will support that as far as the hydration. There's a local group here in town called the 350 Line. It's a group of just regional Metro Richmond fire service professionals. And it's like a little mini FDIC. They put on a great program. They've been doing that for 4 or 5 years now. And we support that during their hot days, not hot temperature, but their hot sessions, just like FDIC.
Right.
And they bring in guest speakers, and we do the recruit burns, fundraising activities, just.
So you're just like the volunteer fire department. You really are. You're right. Involved with the community. You're doing so much more than the official duties.
Right.
It's funny when you talked about taking care of the beagles and things like that. You know, it reminds me of what the great Chief Alan Brunicini always used to say: take care of people, pets, pictures, and pills, and they will remember you forever. And they may not remember the fancy tool you used, or they won't remember, you know, the equipment maybe, but they're going to remember that you helped take care of their pets, their pictures, their pills, and that you were nice to them. And it Absolutely. Sounds like you believe in that also.
We're starting a little program where we're going to start carrying small little backpacks to be able to give out to the displaced citizens, because with COVID and everything right now, the Red Cross, they will help them financially. So they've got their financial part of it taken care of, but they're still out in the street and they've lost everything. So we're going to have an adult male, adult female, infant, child, some backpacks that we can carry on the rig to give them with some basic essentials that will get them through the next 3 to 5 days. You know, some toiletries, some things like that.
That reminds me of something my area did back when I was chief. We actually printed, it wasn't my idea, it was someone else's, but the chief's organization for my community all agreed to do it. We printed a brochure that we were able to hand out to anyone that unfortunately had a fire in their home. And it was called After the Fire. And it was all sorts of information they could use on how to preserve things if they had to replace certain documents and how to properly cover things. I was just filled with information on that could help them get through the next few months.
Very good ideas. Yes. We're always looking for different ways to support everyone. Just not, and we'd also support the police officers. Every fire scene, you have police officers there. We've gone out on some SWAT calls.
Not just fire and emergencies. You're going medical, or you're going on SWAT calls too.
We have gone on a handful when the police side requests us. We had a couple of unfortunately had some line of duty deaths involving police officers that we went out and supported. We're there willing to help everybody. We're getting ready to expand into some other areas. So.
What a great unit. And you mentioned earlier how you really embrace professionalism. Can you talk about what you look for when the word professional is mentioned? Obviously, that's how you and I met. You came to my class. You started following my information on my sites, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, and we exchanged a lot of ideas. And you came to meet me at my FDIC conference. And you certainly really do embrace that no matter what, you should always be professional. So what are you looking for in your members?
I totally agree with your concept that being a professional has nothing to do with a paycheck. And my members will vouch for this. If you want to get me riled up, just say, use this as an excuse. Oh, I did it because I'm just a volunteer. Oh my gosh. Right. professionalism to me, it's how you carry yourself both on duty and off duty. When you're wearing our Flying Squad t-shirt, people don't know that we're a support group. They assimilate. We have the Maltese cross on there. They assimilate us. That person is part of the fire service. So the way you handle yourself off duty, being respectful to people, just the entire gamut.
Gotcha.
It has to come from within, I believe. Like you say, paycheck has absolutely nothing. My wife says I'm really good at creating work, and this has turned into probably, you know, quite a few hours of a week, as you know. So it's mainly an internal, it's like a mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. But what about for the listeners that they understand the importance of rehab? They understand that they need to get their members cooled down and hydrated and looked at and watched over, but they don't have the resources that Chief Korb has. They don't have a dedicated unit in their community. What can a volunteer fire department do to get some basic rehabilitation taken care of for their members? What advice would you give?
It can be as simple as if one of your members isn't able to be considered interior firefighting anymore, don't cast them aside. Don't say, sorry, you can't be interior firefighter anymore. If they have a vehicle that they can get a cooler, some snacks, and some, maybe some cooling towels, a little SUV or pickup truck with one person that can show up and do this function, that's awesome. It's a starting point. It can be really custom tailored to what your resources are, what your personnel limits are. It doesn't have to be the giant canteen vehicle, rehab vehicle, that's $1 million. It doesn't have to be that. It could, we're exploring some quick response type vehicles, little SUVs that we have basic things on that, that can be on scene and tend to the firefighter needs, and it can be expanded or retracted. So there's really no excuse anymore. I mean, I'm passionate about this. All fire departments should have some type of rehab component. It could be as simple as one member that doesn't want to be an interior firefighter anymore, but they're willing to go out on a fire scene with a cooler, some cooling towels, and a bench, something like that.
And today, if you can do it too, get some wipes too, right?
Absolutely. We carry the decon wipes. Yep.
Yep. I think you mentioned that earlier. Rehab includes now the cancer awareness and off-gassing of gear, but also how about the wipes for maybe wiping down on scene before you can get back to the firehouse or home and take a shower? Yep.
We have all the decon wipes that we hand out to people, and especially pay attention around your neck, your jawline. That's where your hood is. Those are prevalent areas where the absorption rates are high, and down in your groin area. Wipe down, decon, wash off. We try to set up a wash station at most where they can wash their face. We always make sure they wash up before they get into our snacks, but for their own health reasons. Yeah. And a lot of this too comes down to, we can do only what we can do, but each firefighter needs to take their own personal responsibility. We all love eating pasta and pizza. I'm guilty as all of us, but hey, once in a while, get out of that lazy boy and maybe walk around the block a little bit, you know. And I think on one of your podcasts, Chief, you mentioned we're always doing stuff as a group in the volunteer firehouse. We're going to fix people's roofs and putting their building walls. Go out and do a walk. Participate in a 9/11 stair climb. We've got a group of guys here and girls that Richmond's a real hilly city, and there's a series of steps, and they just go out there and they meet when they get off duty. And a lot of this comes down to yourself. And you deserve it. You want to live a long time. You want to be healthy. But get off that lazy boy once in a while.
and like you just said, do things together. It builds team camaraderie. And do you do things like that in your firehouse there? Do you do dinners or meals? Or do you exercise like you mentioned together? Do you do team building activities in the firehouse or as a group outside in the community?
This being so new, we are starting to order food, order takeout, or we'll put something in the crock pot for our monthly meetings. We have the 9/11 stair climb coming up. There's a couple of members that are talking about forming a team. So just be active, get your body moving a little bit.
Right.
You get acclimated, especially when the seasons change. When you're going from that winter time into the summer, you're not used to the heat. You're not used to that humidity. So start preparing early and stay prepared. Get off that lazy boy once in a while, guys. Now, trust me, I love my lazy boy. Don't get me wrong. I'm not preaching to anyone. But
No, for sure. And
we want you all to go home safe to your families and live a long, happy life and have all those memories of the great fire service in your head forever.
And that reminds me of what you said earlier when you were talking about how you're treated by firefighters. I got a comment that you mentioned that's your they couldn't be more appreciative in your area, and that's your pay. That's your volunteers' pay, right? With the thank yous and then seeing everyone get back on the rigs and safe and sound back in their firehouse. That is
my payday. And a special thanks goes out to all of our spouses. Every member has a spouse or significant other. They're the ones putting up with the 3 a.m. radio chatter going on. My wife actually is good now at listening to a size up. So here at 3 a.m., my radio's got to come on. I'm sorry. And I listen for the size up. And she'll hear it and she say, oh, this sounds like something you're going on. Yeah. And she'll just turn the light on and help me pick out the clothes and off we go. So every one of our members, because we all know none of these calls come in at the right opportunity. It's either pouring down rain, hot, middle of dinner, in the middle of a family function. So without the support of all of our spouses and significant others from all of our members, none of this would be possible. It's a team effort.
Just like a volunteer fire department, it really is. So what do you see the future? What are your plans? I know you're looking at expanding the duty shifts. You mentioned, I believe you said something about a second vehicle, but what else are you looking to do with in the future here with this Metro Richmond Flying Squad? What are your aspirations?
Our original aspiration was to cover the entire metro region in Richmond. We're happy to announce last week we entered into a memorandum of understanding with the county just to the north of the city. It's the Henrico County Division of Fire. Chief Alton was very supportive. It's a totally career department, about 21 stations, another 550 uniformed personnel. So we are now providing service to the county, wow, which has drastically expanded our coverage area. The city of Richmond's about 65 square miles. The county's another 250. So now we're up to, we went from 65 square miles to 300.
And you may go from 100 calls to 1,000 like overnight.
But, yep, we're going to see where this goes. But our members are all committed to do this. We approached them. This was about a one-year process talking things. And all the members were supportive. They all share in on our vision. And we're not finished with Henrico County. The way the Metro of Richmond, the counties that surround the city are predominantly career. And then the next county's out, you have combinations, volunteer, career. But right now it's the county. And then we're just going to get that operational and work the bugs out again on that and keep it rolling.
That's fantastic. What just, you're to be commended. What a great service you're providing. Again, people, I think, understand that rehab is important. That some places just haven't obviously put the resources into what you've done. And what a great program going on there in the Richmond area. And didn't you sit down and chat with the great Chief Goldfeder even about your program? Did you not? Or were you just visiting him recently? I think you sat with Chief Goldfeder recently, didn't you not?
I was back in Cincinnati visiting some family, and Chief Goldfeder with the Loveland Sims Department, they have a emergency resource unit, emergency service unit. That's ESU. That was Chief Goldfeder's main project, or one of his projects. And he agreed. What a gracious man. I've never met him before. We went out to lunch. We talked, reviewed their entire program. He's very helpful, very helpful. Recently, I was up in Columbus, Ohio. They have a group called Box 15, same setup as us. They've been in existence since they're approaching their 75th year in business, all volunteer. And they just recently raised enough money to buy their own truck with corporate donations and firefighter donations in the city of Columbus, Ohio. So there's about 60 groups similar to ours.
I was going
to
ask you how many other groups are out there in the nation. I know you mentioned the Philadelphia Second Alarmers. You just mentioned the Box 15. So there's other agencies out there. It's about 60 that are doing what you're doing.
There's about 60 broken down into several regions here in the United States and Canada. And it's called the International Fire Buffs Associates. They're on the website. That's actually where when we had the idea here, I reached out to that group, and several of their members were just more than happy to give us information and allow us to get in service as quick as possible. We have a great working relationship. The Richmond's about 100 miles from the District of Columbia. A couple years ago, unfortunately, Lieutenant Brad Clark passed away in a tragic interstate accident on duty. And the funeral, there were probably, typical line of duty funeral, thousands and thousands of attendees. So we requested assistance from the District of Columbia. Their group's called the Friendship Fire Association. And I actually had to request mutual aid from their fire chief. I had to do the formal process, and they allowed them to come down. There's a group just south of us called in Petersburg, Virginia, called Support 6. The Second Alarmers in Philadelphia, the very active group, Providence. I mean, it just goes on and on. The Gong Club up in Jersey City, they're an old group, been around for many years. But yeah, the Philadelphia group, they celebrate 100 years in October, and they're having a nice little commemorative get together. I believe it's October 9th, somewhere around that time. And that group is running about 780 calls. Chief Massey up there has been very helpful. And the rehab circle of people is just like the fire department. I can pick up the phone right now and call Chief Massey in Philadelphia and say, "Hey, Chief, I'm running into trouble with this topic. Can you help me with that?" And he'll set aside what he's doing and say, "Yes." And it's been very helpful. All the groups are more than willing, because we're all in the same boat. We're all struggling with the same things, and we're really struggling with the same things all the volunteer departments are struggling with: membership and finances, and it's the same, really.
Yeah, sure is. Well, great work there in the Richmond area and everywhere else that's doing this. And again, if your agency isn't close to one of these areas, there's so much you can do. Designate non-interior firefighters to start putting your rehab system together at a scene. You know, maybe get some coolers and some chairs and some snack bins and a canopy and some misters. Do you use misters as well to cool people down in the...
Yeah. We have the misting fans. Some people use the arm inversion chair or immersion chairs. I'm sorry. What works the best, I'm not slamming any industry, but a bucket of water and some cool towels, just put them around their neck, their arms, is just as effective. The main thing, getting that core temperature down. And yeah. I'm a big component of passing it on. When I reached out, when I had the idea and reached out to the IFBA members asking for help, more than willing to help me. I'm willing to pass it on to whoever wants to inquire, and maybe we can help them get started. And like I said, it doesn't have to be the full giant $100,000 truck. It could be as simple as someone with an SUV with basic stuff going out to the working fires and incidents. And they can contact me on my email and I'll be happy to talk with them.
Why don't you go ahead and tell them how to get a hold of you, Chief? If people had questions for you and wanted to talk about your program, you have a website, and they can also, if you want to provide your email and contact information, that would be great.
Our website is, it's RVA, like Richmond, Virginia. So RVAflyingsquad.com. And my chief's email address is RVAflyingsquad@gmail.com. Reach out anytime and I will be more than happy to help you all get started with something. That's the main thing. Just get started with something. When rehab came around, it was EMS wasn't sure how they wanted to handle it. The fireside wasn't sure how they wanted to handle it. It kind of fell into the voids. And this is all about your personal health and safety. So it shouldn't be in a void. And I know everyone's doing the best they can with the resources that they have, but I want to see every single fire department in this country have some level of rehab support.
And Chief, you said it so well. You've had a couple good quotes, and another one I picked up from you. You don't even know that I stalked you to pick up your quotes, but fire rehab isn't glamorous, but living is. That's a fantastic quote. And that sums up everything that the Metro Flying Squad in Richmond is all about.
When that sad statistic of 50% of all line of duty deaths are stress, a result of stress and overexertion, that's just tragic. The loss of family members, children growing up without their parents. And again, it's multifaceted. We do what we can do on a scene, but each member take their own personal responsibility,
Well, you're to be commended. All of you are in the Richmond area with the flying squad and elsewhere. Good. It's just, you're doing great work. Chief, obviously so many similarities to the volunteer fire service world, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast to talk about this, not just the importance of rehab, but this incredible unit that you've put together. Do you have any parting thoughts or things you would like to say to the listening audience about rehab, the importance of it, or your unit, or anything like that?
Just, I want to stress the importance of hydration, and that's for everybody. You don't have to be a firefighter. Hydrate early, hydrate often. Be aware of, if you're not feeling right, tell somebody, just tell somebody. And don't feel intimidated by all the NFPA dialogue and all that. Just reach out, give me an email, and we can evaluate your situation and just take it from there. Get something started, just something. And we started with, I used to call it 10 guys in a truck, a truck and a cooler. That's where we started. And we are to where we are now.
Look what it led to. Just look what it led to. Incredible. Yes. Absolutely.
We're not done yet. So
that's great. Just like a good professional volunteer fire department, right? The best is yet to come.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Again, folks, if you want to reach out to Chief Korb, feel free to do so. I know he'll get right back to you. It's a lot of great information. The Metro Richmond Flying Squad, we are there when they need us. What a great line. Or professionally operated by volunteers. Fantastic information. Thank you so much for being here on this episode of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, Chief.
Thank you, Chief. I truly appreciate this opportunity, and I will look forward to next year's FDIC. We got some catching up to do.
Yes, we do, my friend. Yes, we do. Folks, thanks for listening in to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio and tonight's installment to the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. I'd like to thank Fire Engineering and Clarion Events and Chief Bobby Halton, of course, for supporting my podcast and all the other great fire service podcasts that cover so many important topics in our fire service world. I'm so honored to be among them. If anybody would like to reach out to me, my personal email, give me an email, tamerrill63@aol.com. I'd love to hear about what you're doing in your volunteer fire department to maybe make it professional, some of the great programs you're working on. Please be sure to check out any of my social media platforms. the Professional Volunteer Fire Department on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. I'm always posting information and articles and motivational words of wisdom that can maybe help us all navigate through the volunteer fire service world a little easier. I also have a YouTube channel where I upload all my podcasts in chronological order. Got some pretty cool historical videos as well. So please check that out. Give it a subscription and more coming. I keep promising you a new website and I am working on that. It is going to come soon. So I'd love to hear from you all. I'd love to talk to you. So feel free to reach out to me. My next show will be this fall, probably in the October area. I haven't been given the exact date yet from Fire Engineering. Going to be a very special episode. It's going to be my 50th podcast for Fire Engineering. I've got something really special planned. I hope I can make it all come together. So stay tuned for that. I will make sure I post information as that gets closer. And I will be back with you to again talk about our great volunteer fire service. So thanks for tuning in. And remember, true professionalism is not defined by a paycheck. Hey, folks, again, I just came back from FDIC. Millions upon millions of dollars of the latest and greatest firefighting EMS and rescue equipment was on display there. The trade show floor was crammed and it took all day to go through and see everything, even longer if you wanted to stop and talk to the vendors and look and handle the equipment. But you know what? When all is said and done, you're not going to be judged by that new tool you used or that brand new state-of-the-art truck that you drove to the scene. You're going to be judged simply by how you performed and how you treated those people in need. That's all they really care about. They care that you showed up, you helped take care of their problem in a compassionate and empathetic manner, and you treated them with kindness. That's the trademark of a professional firefighter. Folks, our residents are owed professional service delivered by professional firefighters representing a professional organization. Thanks for tuning in tonight. We'll talk to you again down the road. Stay safe and God bless. Thank you.